Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. Lindsay Addario is a photojournalist whose work appears in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She's covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Darfur, the Congo, and Libya. In 2009, she was awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant and the Pulitzer Prize. Addario's book, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, was the 2017 Penn State Reed Selection. I talked with Addario in front of an audience at Sklo Library in State College. Lindsay Addario, thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you all for coming.
So in the course of doing your photojournalism work in conflict zones, you've been kidnapped twice. You were in a terrible car crash. You've regularly seen members of the military and civilians killed, injured. I think the question probably anyone who has read the book would have is, you know, why do this dangerous, scary work?
Well, that question is the question I get asked all the time. And of course, it is the genesis for the title of the book, because I often found myself without a proper response, because for me, it's not, it's just what I do. It's sort of not a conscious decision to go out there and try to get killed or kidnapped or any of the above. But, you know, it's more about I feel this mission, I feel a calling that I've felt since I started photographing. And the more I learned about the world and the injustices of the world and the human rights abuses and the humanitarian crises, I couldn't stop because I felt like a responsibility to continue going back and to continue giving a voice to the people that I photographed.
You had an unusual childhood. You grew up in Westport, Connecticut. Your parents were hairdressers who took in all different kinds of people. Can you talk about your early years and how you think that time might have affected how you've lived the rest of your life?
Sure. I think that my childhood was sort of fundamental for giving me the tools to become a journalist, because I was raised by hairdressers in a very open household. When I was 8 years old, my father ran off with my mother's best friend, Bruce, and has been with Bruce for 35 years. And we were taught from a very young age to not be judgmental.
And you didn't study journalism, photojournalism, in college. You're self-taught. You basically talked your way into a job at the Buenos Aires Herald.
I'm still talking my way into jobs.
So, and you were selling your photos for $10 a piece, but even that took some effort. Would you tell the story of how you got that job?
So I started photographing when I was about 12, and that sort of opened Pandora's box. I started photographing, and I was completely enamored with photography, but I never really took it seriously. For me, it was something that I thought it was a hobby. I didn't know any photojournalists. I wasn't really familiar with people who were able to use photography as a way to tell stories. And so I moved to Argentina after graduating from University of Wisconsin, and my goal was to study Spanish. And when I arrived there, I started becoming aware of pictures in the newspaper. And so I started paying attention, then I went into the local English newspaper, the Buenos Aires Herald, and I went in and I said, you know, hi, I want a job. And there were two guys who just chain smoke cigarettes day in and day out in the photo department. And they sort of barely raised their head and looked at me, and they said, well, do you speak Spanish? And I said, no, not yet, but I will. And they were like, okay, well, go away and come back when you learn Spanish. And so luckily I had already learned Italian. And so I came back like a month later and I said, okay, now I speak Spanish. And they were like, ugh. Okay, so they started sort of making up assignments. And so they would write down the address of some very far place outside of Buenos Aires and say, go take a picture of this address and come back. And I always came back. And so I was sort of the annoying person they couldn't get rid of. And then finally they said, look, Madonna is filming Evita at the Casa Rosada. And if you can sneak on set and get a picture of Madonna, we'll give you a job. And so I said, okay. So I went to the set, and there was this perimeter, of course, because it was Madonna. And luckily there were New York bouncers. And I said, you know, hey, can I come in? And they said, well, where's your press pass? And I said, look, let me explain to you. I don't have a press pass, but my entire future depends on you. And if you let me in, I'm gonna be a very famous photographer. And the guy just looked at me and he was like, you're so pathetic. And so he let me in. And so I then got on the press riser, and I didn't know what I was doing, of course. And I had one little camera and one 50 millimeter lens. And I stood on the press riser and I raised my camera to my eye, and Madonna was like a million miles away. So I sort of just stood there and I thought, I can't believe my big chance. And I got here and I'm not going to be able to take a picture. And the guy next to me very graciously lent me his Hubble telescope of a lens. And he said, you know, he looked at me and he said, hey, kid, give me your camera back. And I just sort of handed him my camera. And he took off the lens for me and he put it on the back of his camera. And I looked in and Madonna was like right there. And I squealed. I was so excited. And he just was like, okay, take the pictures and get out of here.
After you had been there for a bit, you moved back to New York and started to work as a stringer. But you needed money for better equipment. And I love this detail. You ask your father and Bruce for the money that they would have given you for a wedding. Figured you wouldn't need that anytime soon because you were married to your job. It's a thread through this book, the detail of how hard it is to maintain a relationship working as a war photographer, being gone for months, weeks. Talk about that.
So first of all, the first draft of this book that I wrote, there was not a single man in it. There was nothing personal because I did not want my relationships to overpower the how the work was very serious and how it was very important to me, and I didn't want it to undermine the issues that I talk about, particularly because I work mostly in the Muslim world. And I work in war zones, and I work with people who are dying, and I just didn't want to be talking about love because I felt like it was very frivolous. And so I went to, my editor is Anne Godoff at Penguin, and she's the head of Penguin Random House, and she is a very serious, tough woman. And I'm a very sort of bubbly person. And so I remember when she, I was going in for her to offer me the book deal, and she's like, so this is great, but do you really want me to believe you've never had a man in your life? And I was like, like stunned. And I was like, yeah, but you know, I don't know if I want my editors at the New York Times to read about my love life. And she was like, go back and add man. And I was like, and so then I was sort of terrified because I didn't know how to do that in a way that would be sort of tasteful, you know, and so I just thought, what do I do? Because I personally do not have much of a filter, like I kind of say everything. So then I wrote everything, like a lot that thank God did not make it in the book. I wrote a very long draft of the book, and then I hired an editor to help me sort of work in what should be there and what shouldn't.
And now Warner Brothers is going to make a film of the book to be directed by Steven Spielberg, starring Jennifer Lawrence. So she's going to be having your love life.
Poor thing.
Are you involved in the movie at all?
I've been involved sort of in the sense that they send me drafts and ask if things are realistic. But the reality is it's a Hollywood movie. So it's not a documentary. There are things, a lot of things are being changed, but the things that I care about are the fact that the reality of journalism and the integrity of journalism is kept true. And so in that sense, I'm involved. And then I've spent a lot of time with Jennifer Lawrence, and she is great. She's as funny as you would imagine. She's one of the smartest people I have met in a very long time. Not in the traditional sense of the word smart, but she's very, very, very quick and witty and hilarious and reads people in a second. And she's a brilliant actress, so it's really exciting, yeah.
So after New York, you decide to move to India, and not long after that, to go to Afghanistan to photograph women living under the Taliban. There were a lot of hurdles to doing photography in Afghanistan. How did being a woman make that either easier or harder?
So my experience, and that's a question I get a lot, is it easier or harder? Is it harder to be a woman? And in fact, it's a lot easier to be a woman because of the places I work. I work mostly in the Muslim world, and as a woman, I have access to men and women. I think women welcome women in that part of the world, and also men are so sort of confused by what I'm doing running around in a man's world that they just let me in and let me talk to them. So it's really, I think it's really beneficial to be a woman.
What impression did you take away about the people of Afghanistan?
Oh, I love them. I mean, they were incredibly hospitable. They were funny, they were generous, they had nothing. It was a time of extreme poverty and oppression in 2000, and they opened their homes to me. I mean, I had families sort of, when they heard a foreigner was in town, they would hang, because at this time there were no foreigners in Afghanistan. This was really under the Taliban and very hard to get a visa. And so they would sort of hang out the window and say, please come in, come have lunch. And they would literally go into their garden and just start picking vegetables to make for me. And so, I mean, they were incredible. You know, it's just a tragedy that they're still, you know, at war and the country is still sees incredible violence.
So you went to Afghanistan multiple times, took pictures, had trouble selling them. Mm-hmm. You know, no one cared about Afghanistan. And then September 11th, 2001 happens. Mm-hmm. How did the attack on the World Trade Center change things for you, the fact that you had that experience in the country already?
Early 2001, I moved to Mexico City, and my intention was to cover Latin America because I already spoke Spanish and I wanted to cover Latin America. But when September 11th happened, of course, no one cared about Latin America anymore. So the only place that it really made sense to go was Afghanistan. So for me, I fought to get on the first flight basically into Pakistan to be in the region and to try and make sense of what had happened and why it had happened. And so that was actually the first story I pitched and I ever did for the New York Times Magazine was right after September 11th, where I was a young woman in Pakistan and I was spending time at the mosque trying to interview a lot of these women, like what did they think about the attacks of September 11th? Were they happy? Were they angry? Could they believe it? Could they not? And I realized that a lot of people in Pakistan were extremely happy about what happened because they felt like it was justified in retaliation for our support of Israel. And so that was mind-blowing for me. I emailed the New York Times and I said, you know, how about a series of interviews with the wives of these jihadi leaders. And so that was one of the first stories I did for them.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. Our guest is Lindsay Addario, a war photographer who has won the Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work. I talked with Addario in front of an audience at Sklo Library in State College. You often went into these places that were dangerous, where you had to cover yourself in a hijab. And then you go back to your home that's comfortable and you have freedom and you're safe. Was it hard making that shift back and forth between these different worlds?
I mean, it was hard making the shift philosophically. It wasn't hard physically putting on a hijab or going home and then putting on a miniskirt. It was more difficult because I couldn't believe that, you know, most of my life in 2003, 2004, for example, I was in Iraq pretty much all the time and I was with the troops or I was with Iraqi civilians. And, you know, there was a lot of violence and I saw a lot of people lose their life. And then I would go home to New York or to Connecticut and I would be out with my friends and not one person ever talked about the war and I couldn't believe it. You know, for me that was very hard to understand how these two parallel lives could exist.
You embedded with the U.S. military in the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. While you were there, your group was ambushed. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So in 2007, I was working with Elizabeth Rubin for the New York Times Magazine, and she had the idea of doing a story on why there were so many civilian casualties in Afghanistan if we had some of the best technology in the world, and why couldn't we sort of just win this war and get out? And so the idea was to go into the most dangerous place in the country to sort of understand how the mechanism of war worked. And so we went to the public affairs officer and we said, you know, we would like to go to the Korangal Valley. And he looked at Elizabeth and I and was like, it's not really a place that women should go. And we said, well, why not? And he said, well, because where will you go to the bathroom and where will you sleep? And we said, well, where do the men sleep and where do the men go to the bathroom? And he said, well, the men sleep in bunkers. And we said, well, we can do that. And he said, and they go to the bathroom in these like holes in the ground, essentially. And we said, well, we can do that. And so he was very flustered and he said, well, come back tomorrow. And so we went back the next day and he put us on Black Hawks and flew us out to the Korangal Valley. And we ended up spending 2 months there, basically living with the troops. And it was the 173rd Airborne, and they were incredible. I mean, it was a very, very difficult place to be. We were going on 6-7 hour a day patrols through the mountains of the Korangal Valley, 10,000 feet, very, very difficult. We were shot at, we were mortared, there was nothing. I mean, we were literally living in bunkers on the side of the mountain. And at the end of the 2 months, I flew out for one several week stint to go see my boyfriend, who became my husband. And when I came back, the whole battalion was gearing up for Operation Rock Avalanche. The idea was to go into the heart of the insurgency, to literally fly into an area that no American troops had been in years, and to draw the insurgents out so that the American military could then turn around and kill them all. So we were literally airlifted onto the side of this mountain and jumped out of Black Hawks in the middle of the night. Everything was through night vision goggles. And as soon as we jumped out, we heard the Taliban was very close to us because, of course, we have all the technology. We're picking up Taliban intercepts. We can hear what they're saying. We have drone feeds, infrared feeds, so we know we have the command center telling us, well, they're 100 feet from you. So finally, they airlifted us to the Abascar Ridgeline, which is another ridge, and there we got ambushed on the sixth day. And it turned out that the scout team, they were manning the ridge, the edge of the ridge, and the Taliban had literally crawled on their stomach for days and just popped up point blank and shot three guys point blank and killed Sergeant Rugel and shot two others in the stomach. And it was very, very terrifying because, of course, the bullets, we didn't know what was happening at the time. The bullets were coming from three different directions. And I had actually just ran off to try and find a place to pee when the ambush started. And so I was alone, left my helmet and my cameras down below with the troops and had to literally roll down the mountain to get to them. And in the end, Rugel was killed, and then I flew out the next day with his pack because I just had had it.
You talk several times throughout the book about not wanting to seem weak, not wanting to be seen as a woman who can't handle something. How do you think that affected your work? Do you think you were maybe more daring because of it?
Yeah, I do. I think being, a woman in this field, I always felt like I had to sort of overcompensate. I had to prove myself again and again with, whether it was on military embeds, I had to show that I could physically keep up. I was working out all the time to try and make sure I was strong enough to be with them and that I wasn't sort of the girl that held everyone back. I think in Libya, for sure, we should have left a lot before, we did leave, and we got all the warning signs were there. And had I been a man, I probably would have spoken up a lot louder and said, hey, you guys, this is ridiculous, let's leave. But as the only woman, All the guys were sort of pushing to go back to the front line, and I was like, that's insane. We've already been warned twice that Gaddafi's troops are in the city. And so I didn't say anything because I just thought, well, maybe I'm just scared. Maybe it's like I'm a woman, maybe. And so I doubted myself.
And you actually opened the book with the story of that kidnapping in Libya in March of 2011, the beginning of the Arab Spring there. You and the three journalists you're with get kidnapped. Your driver gets killed. And I know you're thinking at the moment, will I see my parents again? Will I see Paul again? Will I get my cameras back? You're lying there with your arms and legs bound, and I wondered, how are you still thinking about those cameras? I was amazed.
Where's Nikon now? Yeah, I mean, look, it's not linear. There have been a few times in my life where I was pretty sure I was dead, and it's not a linear train of thought. You know, I can't explain it, of course. I think, you know, rationally, I would say that I'm out there risking my life to tell a story, and of course, if I'm about to die, I want those pictures to get out. I mean, in Libya, I had such a premonition that something would happen that I actually gave a hard drive of all of my work to Brian Denton the day before and said, because he was going back to Benghazi, and I said, you know, if something happens to us, at least FedEx this hard drive to my agency and they can make sure that the pictures get published. And that's the only reason why I still have pictures from Libya, because I sort of thought something might happen.
And when you are kidnapped, you're beaten, you're groped, worried that you might be raped or killed. Did you think you were going to make it out?
No. I mean, there was, I was also kidnapped in Iraq. And I think, you know, the first sort of few hours is always the worst because whoever your captors are always trying to sort of assert their power over you. But in Libya, the problem was we kept getting handed over to new groups of men. And every time they handed us over, they had to beat us all over again and tie us up and grope. But for me, as the only woman, I was often touched. And I think that that was what was so terrifying because we never knew when it would end. And so it wasn't until we physically crossed into Tunisia that I was able to relax.
And at this point, you had met your husband, Paul, by mm-hmm. then. And somehow during this experience, you decide you want to have a child, which you hadn't wanted before. How were those connected? How
no,
did this
that's
experience?
Not what happened.
I got it wrong. Sorry.
What happened was I always wanted a family, but I was very ambivalent. And of course, because I didn't understand how I could possibly do this work and have a family. But Paul, from sort of basically the day we met, was very insistent that he wanted a family and he wanted one right away. So in 2011, we had been married for a year and a half at that point. And we had made an agreement that in January of 2011, we would start trying to have a family. So I was so terrified that I basically just didn't go home for like 4 months. So I went like January, I went from South Sudan to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Bahrain, to Libya. And in Libya, I got kidnapped. And so, of course, you know, the thing when you're kidnapped is that you feel so horrible about what you've put your family through. We didn't know if they knew we were alive, which in the first 3 days they had no idea we were alive because Gaddafi never admitted to having us. And so by the time we got to prison, it was 3 days in, and it was the first time we were all able to talk to each other. There were no Libyans with us. It was just the four of us in a cell. And of course, the question was, if we live, what will you do? And I thought to myself, okay, well, obviously I have to now have a baby because, like, I can't, this poor guy has been through, like, you know, and he stood by my side. And so I got pregnant like 2 weeks later, basically.
And how has being a mother changed your work?
So I think, you know, it's not so black and white. I think it's a few things. First of all, obviously, I'm aware of my mortality, and I feel like I have to stay alive for my son. That's not something I ever really worried about before, because I assume that if something happened to me, it was, you know, I was okay with those consequences. But also the decision to become a mother, you know, came as a result of having been kidnapped twice, having two drivers who died while working with me. I lost a lot of friends. I mean, it was back to back, things kept happening. And so at that point I thought, okay, I need to pull back. And so, yeah.
In the book, you talk about hoping that your photography will lead to change. What results have you seen from your photojournalism that you're most proud of, that you think have made the biggest impact?
You know, it's hard. It's not like we don't all have sort of the defining photo of our time. You know, I don't have like the Napalm Girl or the, I think that it's more of a collective body of work that has contributed to educating people through the New York Times or through my work in Time or National Geographic. And so there's one body of work that I was made aware of a big change. And in 2010, I was working on maternal death and why women die in childbirth. And at that time, over 500,000 women died a year in childbirth. And so I went to Sierra Leone, where the problem was very grave, and 1 in 8 women had a risk of dying childbirth at that time. And I went to the province, where there was one doctor for the whole province. And I met this young woman who was pregnant with twins. And she delivered the first baby in the village, and the second baby wouldn't come out. So she took a canoe across a river and an ambulance for 6 hours to the nearest hospital, and that's when I met her. And we talked about her life, and she was in school, and she was studying, and she was happy, and then her father pulled her out of school to get pregnant. And so finally she delivered the second baby, and she started hemorrhaging. And as a photographer, of course, I'm not a doctor. And so I was taking pictures and shooting video. And you can hear my voice on the video saying, she's bleeding. I think she's bleeding too much. And the midwives were sort of mopping it up and saying, she's fine. At that point, I started getting like panicked. And the doctor was in surgery. And I actually put on scrubs and went into surgery and said, I think this woman is dying. And he looked at me like I was crazy, and basically like shooed me away. And so I went back to the woman, and she was unconscious at this point. Her name was Mama Cisse. And they picked her up and brought her to outside the surgery room. That's what I recommend. I was like, well, maybe just bring her to him. And by the time the doctor came out, she died. And so there's a whole series of photos and the video, and Time Magazine published an 8-page spread. And they also put up a video that is pretty heartbreaking. And so at the same time, there was a doctor with Merck, the pharmaceutical company, and he had been a young OBGYN in India, and a young woman died in his arms when he was a young doctor. And he saw this body of work, and it really resonated with him. And he started showing the video and the photos internally to the board members at Merck. And they made a decision to start Merck for Mothers and put aside $500 million to fight maternal death just based on those photos. So yeah.
Lindsay Addario, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks.
Lindsay Addario is an award-winning photojournalist who has covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Darfur, the Congo, and Libya. Her book, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, was the 2017 Penn State Reads Selection. Hear more Take Note interviews on our website at wpsu.org/take note. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.